Thank you so much to Century.io and DigitalOcean for sponsoring this week's episode. So, as you may know, I just launched the new Remote Ham Radio Nuxt application, and yeah, turns out it's pretty broken. I've got the Century client in there, and it's reporting every single crash that's occurring. There's tons of errors I've never even seen before, because I don't really have access to the breadth of devices and operating systems and browsers that all my users do. And of course, the users aren't reporting the errors. These are things I'm seeing for the very first time, but I'm still able to go in and fix it. I can do this because I have all the contextual information about every single crash. I got a stack trace, I know which release of my application they're using, I know which user caused it, and I can see a breadcrumb trail, so I can see everything they did leading up to the action. In fact, just this week, a user sent me a video of his iPad showing a crash, and because I knew when it occurred, what user it was, and what operating system it was on, I was really easily able to dig in, find the crash, the exact line that was causing it, and fix it and deploy it right away. It was really, really sweet. And of course, I just have the Century client installed on the browser, but there's also server plugins for Rails and Elixir applications. So head on over to Century.io if you want to give it a try as well. There's a free developer account, which is great for personal projects and early stage applications. Century.io, your code is broken. Let's fix it together. Well, Mikhail.
Rockwell.
Welcome to the show. Welcome back.
Well, I guess this is my second episode, so I guess welcome back is the right word. Sean-less this week.
Yep.
He's out enjoying some time, well-deserved time off, let's say.
Yeah, for sure. What's been going on?
Not much, not much. I guess I've done a bit of a job transition since last time I was on. I'm not so much a developer anymore, but still like to write code once in a while. But no, I've actually been living in a Windows world for a bit. So that's been different, and I think we can chat about some of that in a bit. But yeah, it's weird. It's weird being the guy that runs the servers and everyone's serverless functions. So that's kind of, it's a weird thing. When I was like, oh, no servers. And it's like, no, we're slaving behind the scenes making your servers work.
A cloud is just somebody else's computer.
Yep, and now I get to play with those computers. So it's kind of fun.
That's pretty good. I mean, I was in a Windows shop for a couple of summers at a local, host and development company. And I really enjoyed all the management tools and the way everything was kind of put together. It was nice to have everything kind of coherent and under one roof like that.
Yeah, they really do like their everything's integrated into like AD and .NET Core, or I guess not .NET Core, but .NET and all that. Everything's like all in the same little family. So it's interesting. But I think, just not to bury the lead, but I do think there's been some exciting news coming out of Microsoft's Build conference this last week. Well, I guess last week for the listeners. There's some kind of cool stuff happening over there. They're not the Microsoft of 10 years ago, that's for sure.
Absolutely. It was really funny because we have our little programming channel in Discord here, and this week it's just been one Microsoft link after another. It was like total sea change from what we're used to seeing in there.
To be fair, that is mostly Paul's fault. He is a little bit of a C# fan at the moment, so.
That's okay. He's putting it to good use.
Yeah.
He's allowed.
Yeah, so I guess there's lots of things happening this week. I guess one of the big ones is they've really started to push their like cross-platform, let's say. So if anyone doesn't know, Microsoft's .NET Core, .NET has been like their go-to, like that's how you build anything, like that's how you develop anything for Windows. And they announced a few years ago .NET Core, which let you write, which worked across Linux, Mac OS, and Windows. So you could program tools or applications, whatever you want, across all three OSs kind of thing.
And previously there was also like another stripped down version of .NET. I can't think of what it was called.
I think they used to have Mono was a Mac thing that could work.
No, it was a .NET framework that was like a subset. Okay. It only had like a sum of the original classes. Anyway.
I think I've just rebadged it and kind of brought it up to modern day standards. But yeah, so now they've chucked .NET Core in the trash, and just plain old .NET is now bumped up to version 5, and now it's supposed to work fully across all platforms. So It's like Electron, except you're writing C-sharp code. It's kind of, I'm thinking that's what they're trying to get in there.
Yeah, I read through this. They have a press release here we'll put in the show notes, introducing .NET 5. Mm-hmm. And they explain, like, oh, we skipped version 4 because it's too confusing. They like went from .NET Core 3 to .NET 5.
Yeah.
Because .NET Framework 4 has, you know, been around forever, and they wanted to avoid that confusion, which is great. But man, just trying to search anything just with .NET on Google is, yeah, it's gotten better. But
they need to work on their naming convention there. It's not easy to find this stuff. But yeah, no. So we have a guy at office who's really big into C Sharp, and he's been like really wanting to get more into that. And so now I think he was saying the other day was they're gonna start compiling .NET C Sharp stuff in .NET. They're gonna start compiling that down to what's that new web components? Not web components.
WebAssembly.
Yeah, they're gonna compile it down to WebAssembly. It's gonna run on both Windows, Linux, and Mac. I think they're working on some like mobile stuff too for that. It's they're really targeting the developers with those new releases, actually.
Yeah, I'm reading through this, it's not clear to me that it's totally, like, on the surface it sounds like it's kind of a duh idea. Like, it sounds awesome. Like, if it really is,
yeah,
all under that one name. But scrolling through this, it's like they still mention all the other technologies and how they're going to relate. And it's like, I wonder if it's really going to be as
seamless as they want.
Yeah.
Well, that's weird too, because they also announced React Native for Windows. And it's like, well, yeah. How does that fit? You're all about this .NET 5 that's everything C-sharp and F-sharp and all that nonsense for everything, and now you're going to also do React Native? Like, what? Like, can React Native even work on macOS? Isn't it just purely mobile phones at this point?
I've only ever seen it used for mobile, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess Microsoft is big into TypeScript, so maybe they're betting on all the horses, and hopefully one of them wins.
that's one way to look at it. The other way is that, like, Microsoft is a gigantic company. Maybe it's two totally different teams who are not paying attention to what the other is doing.
Well, it's probably like, oh, we're gonna work on this cool secret project we're going to announce in 2019. And it's like, oh, everyone's doing the exact same thing.
But I don't know. I've never done any React Native. I know it's that also does sound appealing just for the sort of promise of not having to write things twice, especially for, you know, me who's so versed in web technologies at this point. But
yeah, I've done a little bit, and so I've recently just started writing Swift, which is a nice comparison point. But I think the reason why React Native, well, a lot of reasons why it's working, it's taken off as much as it has, it's the feedback loop on, like, when you're developing for React Native is so fast, because it's literally just it's like a web thing, right? Where the browser just reloads. Where with Swift, you gotta like recompile everything, wait for that to happen, then have your app start up, and then see the change, kind of thing, right? Where with React Native, they have a way where it's just kind of on the fly, inject like hot code reloading that new stuff that you've just written, and it just works right away. So it's kind of cool. It's weird though. But React's just weird, just in general.
Someone like made you write a mobile app, would you just use React Native? Like, are people using it without also doing like React web stuff?
I mean, you could. I don't know. I mean, it just, I guess it depends on if you're trying to get like iOS and Android, there's probably a good business case there to use React Native. Versus learning Java /Kotlin and then picking up Objective-C or Swift for the iOS side of things. I may have just because I've just started learning Swift, I really like Swift. I also may also be copying Sean and starting to like types. So that's kind of handy with Swift. It's a strongly typed language versus React Native. I do know there was a big story last year, maybe, Airbnb was a company that went like full into React Native and then slowly kind of took steps back and have been slowly pulling it out of their app. So I don't know if that's just a scale thing or a performance thing, but It's kind of interesting that there's a lot of people looking at it, but I do know they're kind of the big one that I believe actually pulled out of it for a number of reasons. And I think there's like a five part blog post we can find and put that in the show notes for people to have a look. But that was, I think, last year sometime.
Oh yeah, sunsetting React Native. I'll put that in there.
But yeah, so yeah, it's interesting. I guess Microsoft's gonna see if React Native's gonna work in Windows too. Now, there was this week's episode of Full Stack Radio, actually, with Adam Wathen, had a cool episode where they were comparing Vue and React. And as someone who does not like React and much prefers Vue, there was some interesting points where I can kind of see why so many people like React, where it's with Vue. The kind of their point was Vue focuses on the simple way to do things, or sorry, the easy way to do things, and React focuses on the simple way to do things. So it gives you a much smaller scope, but you can do whatever you want with just plain JavaScript, where Vue kind of gives you like niceties and things that just make it quick and easy to do what you want. Where in React, it takes a bit more, but you then also have a bit more control because you're writing just pure native JavaScript at that point, right?
Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it, because React, the API, so-called, of React is very small. Yeah. Like, there's very few concepts and tools you need to understand. You've got components, it has a render function, and like you have to know what this weird, what do they call it?
JSX.
The weird JSX thing. And then you're good to go.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not really that simple, but looking at Vue, it's like, got weird syntax, there's weird operators, the scope of things is not always apparent.
Yeah, and I think the template stuff also is both, like, I really like using templates, but I think that has a few like downsides, because you have HTML you got to work with, right, which isn't nearly as flexible as JavaScript. You can't just have random functions in your HTML.
You can, but you're gonna have a bad time.
Yeah, very bad time.
I always thought of Vue as like the pragmatist version of React, where it's, I don't know, I just personally feel way more productive in it because of the kind of shortcuts that it takes to get things done, and it kind of gets out of your way versus React, which gives you this more, I don't know, CS, high-minded, immutable state, pure functional take on things, which kind of, I don't know, works against a lot of the way JavaScript was designed to work. Not that JavaScript should be a model for anything
nope.
in the way it's designed, but, you know, here we are.
Yeah, I think with Vue 3, they are looking at adding, because I think Vue does support render functions. I just don't think anyone uses them. So maybe with Vue 3, I think there was talk about maybe not exposing that more, but maybe that becoming slightly more prevalent, especially with the move to the focus towards TypeScript. I know they're redoing most of the framework all in TypeScript, so that let me open up some more channels to use JSX in Vue, which I think we just feel weird at this point. It's like a hallmark of Vue is that you get to write just plain HTML templates with a little Vue sugar added on top.
Yeah, that could be interesting. I know people are doing JSX with Vue now, or it is possible, but
yeah,
I've never seen it done in practice.
No, I feel like it goes against everything that that Vue kind of does and does well. Might as well, at that point, just go use React.
Now, the interesting thing about this React Native announcement is that they also include the Xbox 360 in there as well, at least in the like marketing shots of it. And this is interesting because I guess they're implementing, it says they're rewriting many components in C++, which if you go to the repo, it's actually, they wrote the components in C#, and then like, oh no, we're actually rewriting them in C++ for better performance and to better align with the shared C++ React Native core as it evolves, which is, that also seems weird to me, because you've got a web-based technology, but you're rewriting portions of it in C++ for performance. Yeah, I guess I don't know enough about the stack to really know what's going on there, but it seems like really weird move.
Well, I think the whole that's part of the strength of React Native, though, is that it does, you do end up writing native code, compare it to something like PhoneGap or Cordova, those older versions of kind of writing mobile or desktop apps with web frameworks. So I guess it's if you don't have that strong C++, I guess in this case, underpinnings, half the benefits are kind of out the window. You're not going to get that native performance anymore. But yeah, I don't know.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't understand that. So it's not just like little web views. It's actually native components.
No, yeah, I think that's the part of React. That's why React was the framework that made that transition, was that React is just that view layer, and it can, whatever's underneath it, it doesn't really care. You just have to make the APIs for it to do its thing. So yeah, that was one of the benefits of React Native over stuff like PhoneGap and Cordova, was that you were running mostly native code under the hood, which is also why if you do build a React Native app, you're not using H tags and LI tags and stuff like that. You're actually using a subset of HTML elements that are actually have exact replicas in native code. So you're using whatever view is called in Swift, or like a table element. So it's not really writing HTML. You're just using the React API to interface with the native like view components and stuff like that. So that's the big difference with React Native, which is why it was so so popular, because you got to still use React, and you could switch in the iOS or Android underpinnings based on the platform you were then going to compile for, kind of thing. So
interesting. And the runtime is still Node, I guess.
Yeah, I guess there must be some Node somewhere in there. But yeah, so I think something like PhoneGap and Cordova was you were just doing like skinned HTML that was really just a web, like a glorified web view in the end. So that had performance issues, because I played around with that like years and years ago. I think the new versions of that kind of those frameworks are kind of trying to do the same thing as React Native does, but that was the big selling feature with React Native. Yeah, as you may tell, I jump around a lot with tools and technologies that I use. Well, I like to dabble in different things at once. So
you like to dab?
I do not like to dab, but I do like to dabble. I'm not 12. Something else that I think developers may be kind of interested in, at least those that are looking to use Windows, is they're finally giving us a proper terminal, like an honest to goodness iTerm 2, but for Windows, possibly even better than iTerm 2, to be honest. I think June is kind of the target date for it. But it's gonna have tabs. It's gonna be able to be resized, because if you happen to use Windows, you know that at least on, before Windows 10, the command prompt would only go so wide. You can only get so many characters wide for whatever historical reason. So that's,
God forbid you try to highlight something to copy it.
Oh yeah, don't. That's
game over.
Nope. And then I think it was you select stuff and you like right click it to mark it or something. They had weird syntax for that.
Weird old legacy. Who knows?
Yeah. So yeah, it's gonna be any size you want. It's gonna have tabs. It's gonna have I think somehow integrated with like regular command prompt and PowerShell. And which also then leads into like their Windows subsystem for Linux stuff they've got coming. I unfortunately have to use the Windows command prompt a lot, but it looks like maybe in June I will not have to suffer as much anymore.
Are there even any good third-party command prompts for Windows? I've never seen one. PuTTY? PuTTY doesn't count.
There are a couple. I know Hyperterm, which was the like that Electron app. I think the Zeit Now folk make. That does run on Windows, but it still feels like Windows. It doesn't have all the limitations, so you can have full-size Windows and I think you can have tabs and themes and stuff like that, but it's still Windows. this is gonna literally just nullify that whole third party market entirely.
And it looks like it has integration as well with the WSL, the Windows What do they call
Windows
that?
Subsystem for Linux, I believe, is the full acronym.
Which they're actually rolling in a true, honest God Linux kernel into WSL2, which I heard, like, from what I've heard, WSL is already really good, and this seems like the compatibility there is just going to be insanely good.
Yeah, because I think I don't remember how the existing one works, but I think this one's going to be running like the full kernel on a super lightweight virtual machine, quote unquote. So it's as far as you'll be able to tell, it's just pure Linux that just happens to be on Windows. Because I know Sean's played around with doing development on WSL, and I think there's always some issues with some tooling not quite handling the old WSL kind of interaction between it and Windows. But hopefully with this move, it'll just work seamlessly. I think you can even now be able to run Docker, just for example, seamlessly. You won't have to do whatever weird hacky stuff you have to do now to get stuff like Docker working. It's just going to be, honest to goodness, just full on Linux under there.
It does sound really, really cool. We'd like to take a quick break to thank DigitalOcean for sponsoring this week's episode. DigitalOcean is the simplest cloud platform to run your applications on, and it effortlessly scales as your business grows. They've got a powerful administration dashboard, which will manage all your servers, storage, and networking resources under one roof. And they work together as an all-in-one solution to help you save time and money scaling your applications. DigitalOcean services have predictable, affordable pricing, so don't muck around with complicating pricing structures that can lead to nasty surprises on your monthly invoice. You'll always know exactly what your business is paying for their industry-leading price-performance services in their many data centers all over the globe. DigitalOcean droplets, which are like VPSs, are really quick to provision. You can have a virtual machine running in just seconds. And of course, they'll scale to applications of any size. You can provision one tiny droplet or hundreds of big ones. They also offer managed database hosting and Spaces, which is an S3 compatible object storage with competitive pricing. So if you're thinking about trying them out, we're here to help. You can get started today with $100 of credit at do.co/doesnot. You can get a real VPS running in just seconds. Again, check out do.co/doesnot to receive a credit of $100 towards a flexible and scalable hosting solution for your next application. Thanks, DigitalOcean. One of the other interesting things about this terminal, which they noticed, is that it has GPU accelerated text rendering.
Oh, okay.
Which just, it sounds ridiculous when you first read it. You're like, it's just text. Why do I need GPU acceleration?
ASCII but then, art.
Well, yeah, you want to go watch Star Wars Telnet in your terminal? That's the thing you can do. I'll put it in the show notes.
That sounds like a good way to waste a Friday afternoon.
Oh, it's the whole movie. It's pretty great. But this reminded me of, I remember reading this article about Visual Studio Code. This is from October of 2017. Mm-hmm. And Visual Studio Code is written in, I think it's basically an Electron app, right?
It's a
web.
The best Electron app around.
Right. And they found that the terminal that was integrated in VS Code was not performant enough. And so they actually figured out that it's faster to paint canvas elements to the terminal than it is to actually like write just plain old formatted HTML text to it.
Oh, wow.
And so that's what they did. And it says they got anywhere between 5 to 45 times faster than before, depending on the situation. It actually does full like 60 frames per second. And that's pretty crazy. And so when you think about your logging stuff while you're doing development, I mean, I know that that especially I'm doing like large batch jobs and it's logging lots of stuff in debug.
Yeah.
That really, really slows down whatever's happening on the screen because it has to print to IO and wait for it to draw and then come back. And it's faster if I minimize or hide the terminal. So yeah, GPU accelerated text rendering, wild and kind of cool.
Well, I know someone was also saying, oh, we can add emoji to all our bash scripts now. So,
we could do that.
I think they had like some fancy announcement video, like a la Apple. And I think they were running a test suite or something, and they had little fire emojis and stuff, and it was kind of cute.
Is Telnet support UTF-8? Maybe we can give the Star Wars video with emojis.
I think someone needs to try that. Another cool thing, actually, which isn't by Microsoft, but if you use Visual Studio Code, someone found a way to run Visual Studio Code on a remote server. So you can pretty much develop on like a Chromebook or a tablet or anything that doesn't have your development environment on. There's an instance of Visual Studio Code in the browser that in the background is hooked up to some remote server over SSH, which sounds kind of trippy.
Yeah, this reminds me of Cloud9, which AWS bought up years ago and, I don't know, seems to have promptly forgot about. On the surface, man, it sounds like such a good idea. And I don't know if you were trying to lead into this, Microsoft actually announced their own version of that.
Mm-hmm.
But someone did do this. You should put the link in the show notes there. Someone did do this already. You can do this today.
Well, I know there was the this GitHub repo that someone made. It's called Code Server. I don't know how long it's been around. I only heard about it recently. It's quite literally you get, from what I can tell, you get a browser, like in your browser, an instance of VS Code is in the background connected to, I guess you could connect to a VPS or some Docker machine or something. And your dev environment just kind of follows you wherever you go. It's in practice, I don't know how great performance is, but in theory, it could be kind of cool.
Yeah, I guess if you just have that in a terminal. The thing with running editors, with running remote, doing development on a remote machine, for me at least, the biggest hang up has always been the disconnect between basically the file system.
Yeah.
When you're manipulating files, when you got to move stuff up and down, you got to save, you're doing save a lot. And like, if you have a thing mounted over SSHFS, network can be unreliable and, you know, you could lose your mount. And I don't know. It's just never been quite there. Again, on paper, it seems like such an obvious idea. Put my editor, put my full environment on a super powerful, you know, on someone else's server.
Yeah.
and it follows you wherever you go, like you said. But the problem with Cloud9 was, the biggest problem I had with it was really like the editor, the built-in editor is just
not good.
Garbage, right? Yeah. But VS Code is tried and true and proven, and I don't use it, but I could if I had to. And this is cool.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like, I think Coop and also just kind of updated their online editor to be like mobile compatible and can dynamically size stuff. So there, and they've also expanded beyond, which is kind of cool. If you don't know what Codepen was, it was an online service that kind of gave you three little columns, one for HTML, one for JavaScript, one for CSS, and you could write in there and get like a live preview in the same window, and like auto saves, and you can remotely like link to JavaScript files and CSS files and stuff. But it was always kind of a one file thing. So it was only great for like testing things out or to just do like a very minimal MVP of one particular thing. But I think recently they've expanded to include, I have to look up the exact terms, but projects. And so now you can actually have more than one file in your code pen, your pen, quote unquote. It's like there are other companies trying to make it work. And CodePen is great, but I think CodePen was great because it was such a limited scope. Like you could only work within one JavaScript file, one HTML file, and one CSS file. I don't quite know how the new stuff is going to expand to work with lots of different files, but it looks cool.
That's really interesting. Yeah, that's I always see those links on Stack Overflow, basically. People trying to fix their CSS woes.
Yeah, well, I mean, stuff like snippets. JS Bin and stuff have been around for years too. I guess it's always there, but it's never been like it's always been for like one-off like test cases and fixing things. It's never been like, oh, I can have my whole app live here, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the cool thing about this, so there's this code server thing, which is kind of third party and people have developed it, but Microsoft is doing their own. It's called, does it have a name? I don't think it really has a name, but basically they're doing the same thing. You run some kind of virtualized environment. You run Visual Studio in it, and then it also, you basically have like a single sign-on, Visual Studio Online, they're calling it, I guess.
Okay.
And then it basically gives you also like their live sharing, which is supposed to be really good as well,
yeah,
you know, for doing a collaboration with other developers.
Yeah, we've used it at all, but it's not bad.
That's cool. And yeah, this is just another cool thing that just pile it on, you know.
Yeah, it's been a crazy week for them. Just like they clearly showing us that they care. Maybe they haven't for a while. They're like, oh, don't whistle, yeah, don't forget about us. And it's kind of crazy the amount of stuff. And I've gone to their big company, so it makes sense. But they're really starting to throw a lot of good, possibly good stuff. That's the thing with Microsoft, I find, is it the intention is there and the quote unquote the promise is there, but the execution I find sometimes is just there's just too many sharp edges. They don't quite hit every single note, which is part of the reason. Granted, Apple has issues too, but that's why I like macOS and Linux and stuff, is that I know what I'm getting and there's no sharp edges for the most part, whereas Windows just constantly, Microsoft's pushing things forward and they don't always hit it out of the park every single time, but they're trying a lot, like a lot.
Yeah, I mean, look at the whole, I don't know, Windows 7 debacle, or not Windows 7, Windows 8, excuse me.
Yeah.
Right? They tried something new that no one else was doing with the, you know, kind of mobile first operating system, and found it didn't really work so well. They kind of walked back on that a little bit.
Yeah, and Windows 10 has been pretty good. Like it's what Windows 8 should have been.
Yeah, exactly.
So they're learning. I mean, it still has issues. Just don't try to use Windows 10 on a 4K monitor. An issue like blurry icons. A lot of them, a lot of native icons that are like Windows 10 icons, I find in my taskbar are still blurry. It doesn't make any sense.
Oh my God. They're probably still 16 by 16.
Yeah, they haven't handled
8-bit color.
They don't handle high DPI at all well. It's unfortunate, to be honest. But one thing they are trying, one thing they've given up on a bit like Windows 8 is they've given up on Microsoft Edge a bit.
Or Internet Explorer.
I guess Internet Explorer. I guess Edge is being changed. Edge was their replacement for IE, thank God. And they're actually doing some cool things. Like I know they were like you could annotate web pages, and they were like trying to add some features there. But I guess they said screw building their own web engine.
It's probably a smart move, honestly.
Yeah. Oh, maybe we'll see. And they just said, oh, look at this Chromium thing. Let's just take that. So yeah, the new Edge is going to be based on Chromium, which is what Chrome's based on. And they've just released releasing a Mac teaser of it. So you're going to be able to run Microsoft Edge with IE compatible, like IE mode on a Mac, which is a little crazy to think. It's like, I don't, why are you visiting sites that need IE 6 or whatever IE mode they're going to support on a Mac? Like, just no.
Yeah, you got to in some of those corporate environments, though.
Yeah, well, we've actually been noticing because I work in quote-unquote corporate world, and we've actually been noticing a lot of companies are saying Chrome only. They won't work with Firefox or Safari or Edge. So it's like, Chrome's becoming the new IE.
Remote Ham Radio is Chrome only for a long time. It still mostly is.
Yeah, well, it's but, crazy. You don't want to just use one, like what target one browser, but there are the ones like pushing support for things like WebRTC and like service workers and all that stuff. They're pushing all that forward. So it's kind of like, well, kind of have to, right?
And portals now. Do you see portals?
I couldn't figure out what those were. Are they just glorified iframes?
That's what people are saying. It looked more to me like AMP 2.0 or AMP 2.0, where it kind of, yeah, it gives you a little window into another page. So for those who haven't heard about this, it's a new spec. It's not even a spec. It's just like,
just a demo, hey,
we came
it?
Up with this tag. Yeah, it's there's no RFC, there's no WC3 or W3C thing. It's just, hey, we've got this, we've got the blink tag. And yeah, it does kind of look like a glorified iframe where you kind of embed a preview of some other page into a page, and it kind of, when you navigate to it, it kind of expands and fills the screen instead of just navigating to it.
Yeah, it's like a single page application, but for like everything. Like no page refreshes. just constantly things moving on the screen kind of thing, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, no, it looks interesting, but I had trouble finding, like, imagining a use case, really, or a strong use case that that would kind of make me want to use it, but I guess we'll see.
I'll give you a use case: advertising.
Well, I don't see ads anymore in my life.
Fair enough.
I'm a strong proponent of, well, ad blocking, one, because I don't like ads, but two, also for security reasons, because, like, if you follow security news, which unfortunately I have to do a lot these days, a lot of viruses just, you know, kind of get distributed through, like, ad networks, unfortunately. So, but I am a proponent also of paying for good content. So I do pay for stuff like Ars Technica and Wired and a bunch of other sites just because I don't want to see their ads, but I do want to support the people writing good stuff and keeping me informed with what's going on with the world.
So did we get any? I think we got them all. Were there other Microsoft
I think
things we want to talk about on this new Microsoft-oriented podcast?
Yeah, sorry, Sean. No Elixir, no Vue. We are now a C# Microsoft shop. Sorry, not sorry. No, I think that's. I think that covers that. At least that I've heard of. I think Bold may still be going on, but I think that's their kind of. That was that kind of. Hey, this is all the hundreds of stuff we're working on. And it's interesting because it seems like they're really targeting developers and they're really trying to push the envelope forward. They're not just kind of like, oh, we just make Windows and Windows Server and just give us all your money, which they do that, but they're also trying to actually push things forward in a technical sense and trying out some new things.
I always felt that Microsoft's took care of their developers. Like, they really do care, and they really do try to give you the best tools for the job that, you know, kind of aligns with their vision. It really is. When I learned most of my initial development on Microsoft technologies, VB5, VB6, VB.NET, C#, ASP.NET.
Yep.
And, like, it was... When I started kind of learning new things like Ruby and Cold Fusion. Cold Fusion, that's a bad example because that's also had support of a huge company. But, like, going out into the open source world where there's not really one source of truth, there's not really, like, a guiding vision for whatever technology you're working on. Sometimes there is, and maybe it's just not always apparent, right? But it's not like you have the support. There's no guaranteed support.
Yep.
That you get with the kind of warm embrace of a huge company that has the team and the resources to design something cool. So, like, that was very, very jarring for me at first. Now it's my new norm, obviously.
Yeah.
And I tend to seek out technologies that do have the good support, that do have a good, strong team behind them because of that. So I think that it's cool to see this transformation over the past couple of years with their new focus on open source and community feedback and developing tools that are more general purpose and, you know, understanding that they're not the only game in town. They gotta compete with the likes of Elixir and Ruby and everything else.
But it's also nice because I think for the longest time, they were, like, considered, like, the big slow behemoth that, like, wasn't up to date. It was, like, had everything, but it was, like, you know, it was last year's technology. We want this year's and next year's technology. And I feel like they're finding that balance between that cutting edge, like React Native for Windows or, you know, stuff like that, but then also still kind of keeping that comfortable baseline of, like, we're still Microsoft, we still care about you, we're still going to hug you and going to make you use all our tools because that's what we want and that's how we can kind of give you this good experience. But maybe they're trying to push things forward a little bit, at least on the outskirts.
Yeah, I mean, it's only good things, right?
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so it's an interesting world. One thing I do want to say is this is finally going to be the year of Linux on the desktop.
Yay!
It's been coming. We're finally getting it, and it's because of Microsoft. Just remember that. but yeah, otherwise, it's going to be interesting. Hopefully, hopefully you get a look at some of the new stuff that Microsoft's coming out. I know a lot of us focus on the web world, but they've got some cool stuff coming out that hopefully we all get to play with.
I was looking at .NET stuff. It's not .NET 5 is not coming till like November of next year.
Yeah, this so is a long time.
Still a ways out. Obviously, they've got their timeline out to 2023 at least. So
yeah. Well, again, that's one of the benefits of a big company that's got like is thinking to the future, right? So
yeah.
Otherwise, if you're interested in feedback, please add Sean. He will answer all your questions about Microsoft.
What's your Twitter handle?
@_MikhailBot.
Okay. Well, yeah, we always appreciate feedback. You can tweet at us, shares, likes, ratings on iTunes. Always useful. As Mikhail mentioned, his username, we are @DNCShow on Twitter. Myself, I am Shrockwell.
And if you're looking for show notes, you can visit our lovely site at dnc.show, and we'll make sure Sean gets some good show notes up there for you guys.
Also post show notes over on spectrum.chat, where we've got a channel devoted to the show and a bunch of other developer topics and design topics. You come over there and chat with us and say hello and discuss the show with us.
Yep. And as always, thank you to spec.fm. If you're looking for a job, they still have a job board up there if you want to go to spec.fm/jobs. And I think, as always, we want to say thanks to Spec, letting this week me and Rockwell ramble on for a bit. And if you're interested in other developer design shows, you can check out spec.fm.
And as always, this episode of Does Not Compute was edited by, well,
me.
You guessed it. And produced by Sarah Jackson. All right, Mikhail, this is fun. Good talk.
Yeah, I think I need to throw my Mac at the door and go pick up a Surface Book.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Thanks again to Sentry.io for sponsoring this week's episode. Don't wait for users to report errors in order to act on it. Iterate on your application faster, improve customer happiness, and make a better product with Sentry's comprehensive error reporting platform. Check them out at Sentry.io. And of course, thanks to DigitalOcean as well. DigitalOcean really is the easiest cloud platform to run and scale your applications. Visit do.co/doesnot and sign up to receive $100 of credit towards your next application.